You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 78 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Thank you to everyone who continues to leave us a review. If you haven't done, please do so. And I will stop asking everyone. Today, we are joined once again by Sarah Fox, who is a construction contract expert. She's the founder of 500 Words, a business delivering simple, digital, trust-enhancing contracts, starting with just 500 words. Welcome back today, Sarah. How are you?
Yeah, fine. Thank you very much. It's a beautiful sunny day when we're recording this, so all is well with the world.
We'll keep it brief so we can go out and enjoy the sunshine, right? No, it's great to have you back on the show. It was way back on episode 44 that we first spoke. And at the time, we were speaking a lot about what your mission was, or that episode was kind of about 500 words as a business, which was all about making construction contracts shorter. If anyone hasn't listened to that episode yet, go back and have a listen. It's really, really interesting. How is your mission in life to make construction contracts shorter? Sarah, how's it going?
It's going really well, actually. I have been introduced to a huge client in the UK who wants radical simplicity because they've realised that they can't, even though they've got existing contracts, they don't use them. They can't operate them. They're failing to achieve what they want to achieve as a business. So the strength of the story is spreading. Hurrah.
I have to say, radical simplicity might just about sum up your entire business proposal, right? Radical simplicity. I like that a lot.
So I like that phrase so much, yeah.
I'm going to steal it. I'm going to take that one. I really like it. But so business is going well, and do you see the industry starting to think, you know, we don't need a 50,000 word contract anymore. Maybe we can slim it down.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of driver from both clients and from, you know, subcontractors and smaller businesses. I always thought smaller businesses would kind of get it quicker because anything that makes their life easier, the admin less, that would be great. But big corporates, and I do some work with World Commerce and Contracting, not in the construction sector, and there's a lot of global corporates are saying our contracts are so long, they're stopping people bidding for the work. So we're not competitive. We can't innovate because startups tend to be smaller companies without legal departments. It's slowing down the speed by which we can go from thinking we've got an agreement to getting it signed off. That's no good to us. We need something called deal velocity. I mean, that's kind of proper jargon, isn't it? But they really,
Get into it now.
Yeah, they really want to drive the project rather than drive the paperwork. So really interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, we've been doing it the wrong way around, haven't we? If you think about it like that. And that's obviously what we talked about last time around. You know, we talked to a lot of prop tech, con tech entrepreneurs on this show, or we have done, and they're talking about like their vision for the future. Your business, I was so impressed by it, so impressed by your passion and your concept and your emotion around it, because it really resonated with my experience. Do you think construction contract, we're going to look back in 20 years at a different industry when it comes to construction contracts? Do you feel confident?
I think we might end up in a sort of a three-tier industry. So that we might have, for the multi-billion pound global projects, they're going to stick with their massive contracts, their FIDIC and everything else. And they're normally, a lot of the players in that market are really large corporates anyway. So that suits them. And, you know, they like the complexity. It makes them feel comfortable. I think there's going to be anything that's funded by banks will probably end up staying in a kind of a middle tier where the banks drive risk averse, long contracts and everything else. And where people have the ability, because they're either funding it themselves or they've managed to persuade investors to work on a different basis, I think that's just going to go different. I think it's going to go simple. It's going to go digital. It's going to move away from really long contracts driving the, you know, driving more paperwork. And we're going to end up with really simple, probably, you know, partly automated contracts that people can use on their smartphone. and they don't actually have to have a huge back office to support all this function.
To run it, which is the logical, simple approach. I run a startup. I know exactly what it's like to not have a legal team in-house. I used to work with a big company where they did have a legal team in-house, but I want simple, exactly, I want simple, easy to manage contracts which just help the wheels keep moving. But
yeah,
fascinating stuff. I get so excited to talk about contracts because I'm such a loser that I've forgotten to even ask you to introduce yourself to the listeners. I know some will know who you are. I've heard from you before, but just tell us very briefly about you and your experience.
So I'm a contracts lawyer with 25 years looking at construction contracts. I always say 25, it's getting longer, but you know, that sounds like the right amount to say nowadays. And I've also, I qualified as a trainer. And when I started training people, and more people I trained on construction contracts, the fewer and fewer people I realized actually understood what they were doing. And that was all the way through from lawyers to legal advisors, contract administrators to the parties. I thought, well, this is just...
If the lawyers don't know, this is what hope do the rest of us have?
Yeah. This is just a disaster because this is now a tool which is just an industry in itself, takes a lot of time, energy and effort, and actually doesn't serve any of the relevant parties. So actually, we've created a kind of monster, a Frankenstein monster out of various bits and parts, and the internet really has helped us to copy and paste big chunks of absolutely irrelevant stuff. And then what happened during the pandemic, everyone knew, was they flicked through their contracts, tried to find the solution to the pandemic, couldn't find it. And that has been quite a big bump into some people's backsides to say, actually, maybe what we've done hasn't been working. And also during the pandemic, of course, nobody could find their hard copy paper-based contracts because they were stuck in an office they weren't allowed to get to anymore. So there's been quite a number of drivers, and, you know, the tech drivers, really important because they're kind of creating a whole contract life cycle management sort of system so that you can agree, negotiate, manage the contract online. So you can also access it through a smartphone, all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, none of the paper contracts come with a dashboard. And frankly, what is life without a dashboard nowadays?
Oh, you're preaching to the converted here. I'm often, when I'm doing this, when I'm recording a podcast with an interesting guest like yourself, I'm often looking for a segue from what I want to ask you, from what you are saying. And you just said something which is going to give me a segue, or I think I'm going to try and take your segue. You said that during the pandemic, people were all of a sudden flicking through their contracts, thinking, God, I've got an EOT claim here. What the hell do I do? I'm actually going to have to need to dust off this contract and have a look now, right? Today, I want to talk to you about supply chain, inflation, and all the challenges around that. So here comes my segue. So we're no longer in the pandemic, but we are in a real crisis of sorts in the construction industry in terms of the supply chain, and I've sit with my business right in the middle of that supply chain, seeing what property developers, main contractors and subcontractors are all doing, how they're interacting, etc. Right now the problem is inflation. I think we're at about 9% inflation, I think it came out again this week. Whatever the numbers, we all know that we're struggling. Construction, supply chain prices getting worse and worse. I did a seminar, I spoke a few months ago, where I was talking about what happened in 2021, 20% material increases. We all know this, everyone knows this. So I think I've gone past my segue now, haven't I? I've kind of ruined it. I was onto something, but I've gone past it. But I wanted to talk to you today. I wanted to lean into your expertise with regards to construction contracts, and people are starting to dust off their construction contracts and go hunting for
the one clause that, allow them to. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you're right. And the problem we've got is we've had such a stable price range for such a number of years, you know, decades effectively, that the mechanisms that are available or have traditionally been available in the standard form contracts, like the NEC contract, I think it's X4, or like the fluctuations provisions in JCT, were routinely deleted. People didn't believe them to be appropriate, so they didn't have them in. Whereas now they're absolutely relevant, but they're not in their contracts. So we've kind of got a few problems. We've got people with existing contracts to deal with and people who are about to enter into a contract to deal with. So let's deal with the existing contracts first. The problem for a lot of the existing contracts is we've gone for fixed price. Fixed price was a mechanism by which clients could get cost certainty at the beginning. with a few changes, admittedly, but they at least knew what their budget was, could get funding for it, that kind of stuff. That's been really well preferred in the market. The problem with a fixed price contract is it's exactly that. It's fixed. If you provide the same goods, materials and services that you already asked to do, that's the price you're going to get paid. So one of the mechanisms that people can use is try and use a change mechanism and just say to their clients, you know, this is what's happened. This is what we may need to change. Can we have a discussion about it? They might not have a right to get the client to kind of change this, but they might actually have the ability to get the client to change it. A lot of the contracts that we have, the existing contracts, don't have the right for the contractor even to propose changes.
Because, jump in there, so there's a difference between variation and fluctuation, right? Like a significant difference between the two. So I'm going to try to exemplify something that I got told about by one of my clients recently. So the discussion for that client was they were due to commence the works in December 2021. Things got shipped, the main contractor agreed their price, fixed price, as you say, lump sum. Didn't start on December 2021. 6 months later, final planning was achieved, June 2022. The world of supply chain and inflation had completely changed between those 6 months. So there's a difference between fluctuation and variation, because some people say to me, oh, I've got a fixed price lump sum, therefore I can't have any variations. You can have a variations if elements change, right? If I say I don't want it to be brick, I want it to be block work, or bad yeah. example, but you.
But one of the ways of dealing that would be to say, the reason we need to make a change, because if I stick with the specification that we agreed, then that price material has gone up 60%. I can't afford to finish this project on that basis. If we change the specification of that, or we change to a slightly different material, or we can agree that circumstances have changed, so it's not my fault the price has gone up, then we could continue with this project. But we're struggling. And I think a lot of it is about open, honest communication, because most of the clients know this stuff is happening. They, however, still have to have the conversation with whoever's funding their project. So it could be that they've got bucket loads of cash sitting around just waiting to be spent, but probably not.
Unlikely.
So we need to manage the kind of the chain of where this money is coming from and how we're going to deal with it. So you're right that, generally speaking, a change mechanism is dealing with changes in scope, methodology, working hours, restrictions. That kind of doesn't really fit the bill. But some contracts, if they're simple enough and they're generic enough, will allow you to propose changes for other reasons, including events beyond the control of the parties. So if you've got events beyond the control of the parties, which is, say, the Russian war and the impact that's having on a lot of materials, or the continued effects of the pandemics, there's no reason why you can't say, I know it doesn't strictly fit within this mechanism, but can we have a discussion on this mechanism? Because this is the way that we're actually going to continue with the project. And I think that gets us away from kind of strictly looking at the kind of I's and the T's and all this kind of stuff in a contract, and kind of looking at the precise wording and going, actually, the purpose of a change mechanism is to take into account things that we didn't know were going to happen at the beginning of the project. This is the right mechanism, even if it doesn't strictly say we can do it for these reasons.
And that's what I really like about your proposed solution there, is typically, or not typically, but there's this big 20% problem sat on our desk, right? And the typical way is to say, right, I'm going to find something that proves that isn't my problem, and just try and push it back over to the developer, and the developer will say, vice versa, not my problem, it's your problem. And you're getting absolutely nowhere. What you're actually advocating for there, which is really interesting, I hadn't even thought about that, is to say we can vary the contract to make it work for both of us, because on current grounds it doesn't work for either of us, or it's going to work very badly for one of us and not the other one. So how can we go about that? Is that something, flipping it the other way around then, fluctuation provision, or how would you go about saying this is completely not my problem?
So a fluctuation provision basically says that if specific types of materials, sometimes it's labour, sometimes it's just materials and goods, goes beyond a particular price range or beyond the base price, that's normally defined in the contract, or whatever's in the pricing documents, then you can apply to have an increase in those materials and those that labour. And that's how it works. So it basically gives you a second bite to come back and go, wow, You know, we can absorb 5% maybe, but we can't absorb 60%. We know some supplies in the UK construction sector have gone up 60% in 6 months. Nobody can absorb that. So it's kind of like moving away from the toddlers in the playground, my side of the contract, your side of the contract, my side of the contract, which is kind of maybe, shall we say, the traditional way we've done things in UK construction, to taking a slightly more grown-up approach, which says the purpose of this project is to achieve X. Is there a way that we can achieve that by taking a slightly different route where we both get to the end reasonably happy? I'm not going to say anyone's going to make a lot of money, but at least not absolutely insolvent and losing money hand over fist.
It works both ways, doesn't it? So if you're the main contractor and you say materials have gone up 20%, that's my margin gone, sorry, can't do it, your problem. Developer probably says, well, construction's gone up 10% for me now, scheme is not viable, nobody wins, right? Absolutely nobody wins. What I always understood about fluctuation provisions was that largely they were applicable on longer projects, on projects that lasted for a long time, for example, like a Crossrail, it goes on for 10 years and then it becomes more viable. Is that not right?
Well, no, because largely they've been used in the last few decades on that sort of project, where, for example, if you were doing a contract for HS2, which is going to take 20 years, or Hinkley Power Station, which is going to take, you know, decades, then you would need to build that in because the impact of compounding inflation every year would just be catastrophic. But actually, there's no reason why you can't have it on a really short form, even if it's just a 3 month or 6 month project, because we don't have the historical certainty of prices that we have had previously. So actually, everyone's a bit edgy about the whole thing. And I think one of the things in terms of future contracts, people have to be careful about making their bids and their tenders valid for a specific amount of time, a right to review the price until they start work on site, until we get that agreed, a right for the contractor to propose changes that will help them produce the same result for the same price by changing quality or changing methods or changing design. And also just a right for them to say, this is a big change, we can't absorb it. We're prepared to absorb price increases of a rate of inflation of 5%. Anything above that, we'd like to come back to you. I'm working for the Federation of Master Builders, and they're looking at now at a prime cost contract where they get a particular percentage on top of the cost to the contractor of doing it, because they said, we can't control costs. Literally, if we ring up a supplier, they're saying, I can tell you what the price is today, but I can't tell you what the price will be tomorrow. And that makes it really difficult.
That's our experience as well.
It's really difficult. So essentially, we're going to move away from probably lump sum contracts, move towards what's known as prime cost or cost plus contracts, where a contractor gets paid the cost to them plus a percentage for managing it. That's basically it, because that's the only way you're going to have a fair reward. Clients don't like that. Funders don't like that. So there's going to be an element of, you know, jockeying to see who gets the right thing. But there's other mechanisms they can use. So you could have, you know, a fixed price plus a mechanism for recovering any additional cost beyond a particular price. You could get the clients to start buying some of these supplies. So they free issue them to the contractors for the big bits that we know are very unstable. We could have much earlier procurement mechanisms and looking at spending more time doing the pricing and we trying to guess where the prices might go and then how we could value engineer that before we start. There's all sorts of ways of doing this, but they all require grown-up conversations, not a we've always done it this way.
Early grown-up
conversations,
yeah.
Rather than we've always done it this way and you gave us a bid, you know, 2 years ago and therefore it's like
I'm gonna beat you around the I completely
happen.
Agree. Okay. Fascinating stuff. And let's talk more about it right after this breaks out. Hello, it's me again. I wanted to share a quick story with you on why I co-founded Sealink with my best mate Chris. Chris and I, we're both QSs, and this is going to sound sad, but one night we were sat in the pub talking about subcontract tendering, and we realised the industry had a problem. Number one, procurement was too paper-based. Number two, it was too time-consuming, and every QS had their own unique way of doing things. And number three, perhaps most importantly, if you want to competitively tender, you need to know hundreds of the best subcontractors. We simply didn't. That's why we created Sealink, its software to solve subcontract tendering. We wanted to remove these challenges and help the industry get better. So if you or someone you know tenders with subcontractors, you've got to see our software. Head over to our link, www.get.c-link.com/podcast, to find out more. I will include it in the description box. So again, there's no excuses. Now, let's get right back to the show. Sarah, you are the guru for these things. This has been enlightening for me. I want to talk about something slightly different in the second half of the show, but just before we got kind of cut off there when the end of the half came about, we're on to something really good. I just think, for the sake of anyone who, whether a subcontractor or a main contractor, someone who is tendering at the moment, how can they best protect themselves given what's going on, in your opinion?
Well, I think there's a number of things they have to do. One of the things is they have to make sure that the validity of their tender is quite short, so that the prices are only, you know, stated for a particular amount of time. They also might want to...
How short?
I'm thinking probably about a month maximum, because prices are changing on a daily basis. They also might want to put in a statement that says they reserve the right to review the prices just before the work start, because if the works get delayed, like your example was, then they can have another check before they start. I'm not suggesting that they're going to start tying suppliers in, because suppliers aren't going to be tied into prices. So there's another number of different ways they can not use a lump sum price. They can use a cost plus or prime cost, which is basically materials and labor plus a profit percentage, which covers overheads and prelims and stuff. They can also, if they want to, if the client says, no, we must have some sort of fixed price, I think you can have a fixed price with a mechanism to rank up for specific materials that go beyond, say, 4%, 5%, whatever they could absorb. But the other thing you could do is get clients to actually enter into the supply contracts themselves, because then they see that they're not in control for that bit. Now, that kind of depends on how it's being funded again. But there's all sorts of...
I think that's quite a good way to flip it, though, isn't it?
Yeah. We can't get it at that price. Why don't you try and get it at that price?
You take the risk. Yeah, we're happy for you to take the risk.
Sophisticated developers and clients might want to do that. The unsophisticated were absolutely hands-off. But they're probably the more problematic, because they don't
do
these...
to shift the dynamic, though, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't do these projects on a very consistent basis. So if they're sophisticated, lots of early procurement, lots of all early chats, lots of redesign, always try and make sure you've got a right as a contractor or provider to make changes to the works where necessary. Because there are some things, not that the prices are just increasing, we just can't get anymore. Okay, that's just not happening. The supply, you know, I think it's sort of 18 months wait list for certain things. So actually being able to say, well, we can still meet your deliverable, your output, which is pretty much what all construction really is about, but we're going to have to change the inputs. And that's, you know, one of the things that we can do is actually, you know, put control back to contractors and say, you know the market better than we do at the moment, and it is changing rapidly. So please, you know, let's take a grown-up conversation about this going forward.
I like it. Well, that's fantastic advice. I'm sure there are people listening wildly scribing down these things, thinking about how they're going to approach their next tender. And it will certainly help me when I'm speaking to some of the clients that we speak with day in, day out, to deal with these challenges. So thank you for that. I now want to steal even more of the good ideas that you have in your mind. Sarah, on a slightly different topic. So you wrote an article recently called "Do You Have a Right to Finish Your Scope?" Could you talk to us about that article?
Yeah, so this has been a pet topic of mine for quite some time. It goes back to the whole purpose of a legally binding contract, is it obliges the contractor to carry out the whole of the scope, but also gives them the right to carry out the whole of the scope. And most people, when you say you've got a right to carry out the works, they kind of go, that's a useless right, isn't it? Well, yes and no, because I think, well, actually, I've got an obligation. But it's when you turn around to them and say, well, if you've got a right to finish, then the client isn't entitled to withdraw or descope or omit works without your permission and without compensating you, because you price for a scope of works in a specific way based on the full value of the work. So for example, if to take a really simple example, if you were doing a housing development, you were the bathrooms guy. You were the bathrooms company, and they said, okay, we want you to do 100 houses, build these lovely bathrooms, and we'll pay you. What's your rate per bathroom? Not that people do rates per bathroom, but imagine they did. And then sort of two houses in, they decide there's been a pandemic. Nobody really wants bathrooms. They want home offices. We're not going to have any more bathrooms in houses. So we don't want any more bathrooms. We'd like to take 98 of the houses out of your contract. You're kind of going to feel a little aggrieved, aren't you? Because you've just priced it on the basis of buying 100. You may even have started to spend costs on those other, you know, 98. So clients tend to think they've got a right, because they've got a change mechanism, which we've already talked about, to take work away from a contractor. And that's not technically the case.
God-given right is how some of them, in my experience, have felt.
Correct. You know, it's freedom, it's flexibility. They don't know what they might want to do. They, you know, they want to, you know, chill slightly. They take a bohemian approach to whether or not you have a right to do something, and slightly less for themselves. So there's been a case that was started. There was a case in the 1990s which talked about this right to finish. And I used to talk about it quite a lot because it was to do with change mechanisms. Does the contractor have a right to finish the whole of the scope? And they said it did. And basically all the clients ignored it and the contractors didn't know about it. So we had a bit of a loose practice when it came to change mechanisms. And then a case came to do with the Aberdeen Harbour extension. So it was a big case, millions of pounds worth of work going on. And these were contracts between a main contractor and their subcontractors. And basically this main contractor decided that it had a particular series of works packages. It would have three subcontractors, and it gave the same works package to each three of them as part of their scope of work. So they all had other things to do, but it basically was kind of thinking, I'm not quite sure which of these I want to work with. I don't know how competent they'll be. I don't know how nice they'll be to work with. I don't know what their price is. I'll work it out later. I'll give it to all of them, and then I'll decide which one I like enough, and I'll take it off two of them. So they took this work, and it was a big chunk of work. I think it was about £1 million worth of work, but don't quote me on that. It was quite a big chunk of work, and they took it away. And the subcontractor looked at their contract, took it out, flicked through the clauses, went, hang on, you don't have a right to do that. So the contract had been drafted. So there was an express right to descope, but only if it had been taken out of the main contractor's scope. So they're basically saying, if the client doesn't want it anymore, then we don't have to provide it, so we won't need it off you. And that seems a fairly good reason.
And that's relatively standard, right?
It's relatively standard, but there's quite a lot of standard drafting, which is really poor on this. most main contractors have a right to take work away, sometimes for any reason, and sometimes because it's no longer in their scope. And you know what? As a subcontractor, you can't provide something they don't want. So you might be happy to agree to that. But this wasn't work that the client didn't want. The client still very much wanted this work, but the main contractor had decided that they weren't the subcontractor that was going to keep it. So they took this big chunk of work away, and they ended up falling out massively, terminating the subcontract, went to court. The court said, no, there is no right in your contract. Yeah, went to the Scottish courts, no right in your contract to take away the scope of works unless it's no longer in your scope. That doesn't apply. Therefore, this is a breach of contract.
What were the other subcontractor doing at this point? Because there's another one who didn't get the work.
One of them was doing the work. One of them was doing the work. The other one, I think, was waiting to see what happened.
Hilarious. Because I'm just thinking, well, I've got commercial.
Yeah, much cheaper to learn from somebody else's mistakes, remember? Much cheaper to watch somebody else's court 100%. Proceedings than issue your own. So then they said, well, the thing is, if you take work away, you have to compensate them because you promised to pay for the whole of the scope of the works. They set up their business. They were going to earn profit on it. If you take work away and you don't have a right to do that, that's a breach of contract. They're entitled to compensation. And it actually said, if you want this right to omit works, you should compensate them for works you're no longer asking them to do, but which they've included in the way they've calculated whether they're going to do the project in the first place and also how they price the rest of it.
Exactly, because so this, as a subcontractor in my history, now what would often happen, so I was a full building envelope contractor, so we would almost always, 80% would be lovely unitised curtain walling that we would do, then another 10% might be a bit of roofing and cladding works, another 10% might be, you know, like the doors and so on the ground floor. And often, I was doing it for 10 years and maybe on, probably did 20, 30 projects, and probably on 30% of them, main contractor would say, oh, we're going to do those doors now, I'm omitting them. And we would say, to be honest with you, I mean, the funny thing being, to be honest with you, we didn't particularly like doing doors. It was always the hardest bit, believe it or not. So, but you have to kick up a bit of a stink, don't you, of course. But we would, on a serious note, you might have, say it's £1 million contract, and using my numbers, 800,000 was the curtain wall, 100,000 was the doors, and 100,000 was the roof, let's say. And we had a lot of profit in the doors, but we'd given them our overall risk and profit for the job at 1 million. They had no right to do it. We would often have arguments about that topic. But what I always found challenging was, A, there would often be clauses saying they can do whatever they want, which, sustainable or otherwise, made the conversation more challenging. But B, if you were successful in saying, okay, on my door package, which is 100,000, I want my profit of 20%, let's say. You can take them out, but I'm keeping my profit of 20,000. That was a almost impossible conversation to be having. And so I've just felt whatever happened, no matter how much you won the argument or were in the moral high ground, actually achieving anything was very difficult. Is that
completely true. And in fact, one of the things that the court did actually say was, if you want a right to take the work away and do it yourself or give it to another subcontractor, you need really clear words that you're doing that. But they still said the subcontractor should be compensated. And actually, really interestingly, the FIDIC short form green book, which has just come out, has now put in a right for the client to omit any works, and saying that it will pay the contractor 10% of the value of those omitted works by way of compensation.
Now, that's a really good
idea,
isn't it?
So it's pre-agreeing what your lost profit would be. I think it's genius. I think it's the best bit of drafting on omitted works I've seen for a long time. Because I've said to clients all the time, and I've said this to contractors and subcontractors, I said, look, if they don't want these works anymore, just allow them not to have it. Because why would you try and force them to have something they don't like? That's trying to feed me a Brussels sprout. I'm not having it. I don't care. It doesn't matter what you pay me. No, I'm not a cabbage fan. Anyway.
Oh my God. I thought we were having such a good time here, and then you've thrown that at me.
Give them a right to, you know, change their mind, but make them say, yeah, you can have that, but you've just got to compensate me for it. I think.
Well, what it's going to do is make them not change their mind. It's going to make them think about it with gravity at the start. It's going to make them think, let's put all
absolutely
three.
Right. So the main contractor is not going to triple subcontract the same works package, because unless it can get it at least 20% cheaper by taking off two of them, it's not going
to
be in the money.
I've never heard that before, though. No, what a strategy that was.
I know. Well, one of the arguments in the court was whether the contractor's motive affected their ability to do this. And they said, actually, they didn't actually call them underhand, and they didn't say anything about it. They said it wasn't relevant, how they'd done it or why they'd done it. But it was a bit of gaming the contract massively. So I think main contractors will still want the freedom to be able to omit works. But I think good subcontractors will go, okay, that's fine, have it, but pay us 10% of the omitted works, because that will stop the kind of gaming bit. It will make them think about it in advance. And I think it means...
It'll make me think that... Yeah.
It's much quicker to agree the compensation if it's already written into the contract. If it's 10% of the omitted works, most people would take that.
Yeah, you go back to my example, and it was just random numbers out of the air, but I'm trying to get that 20%, which maybe is more like 15 or whatever. If you're just guaranteeing me 10%, and someone says, we don't want you to do the doors anymore, we're going to get it done elsewhere, we would have probably said, absolutely fine, no problem, happy day, see you later. But it's just the fact, it's... In many cases, when I speak to subcontractors or even main contractors who are having it done to them by the developer, right? It's not always just main contractors to subcontractors. It's more the principle of this, the approach to these matters, which is that you just feel like the client is just steamrolling you and saying, right, we're doing what
we have
doing.
A right.
Unlucky, and you think, you absolutely don't, and I need to... But you can't win, so...
The whole point of a contract is that you don't have a free right to do
exactly,
anything. Otherwise, we have a free right to walk away. Now, which would you like? You can't have your cake and eat it. So, yeah, I think it's really useful. And I think what you see a lot at the moment is people having a right to omit works or end the contract at any time without any reason, but not paying the compensation. I think we need the balance to come back into contracts to say, yeah, okay, if you want those rights, they're pretty harsh because we've got a contract to do all this stuff. You can have them, but you've got to compensate us. And I think that's a really useful way of kind of creating more balance for contractors and subcontractors through the chain of contracts.
I completely agree. And so advice to subcontractors in that regard is to be very aware of an omission clause when you're signing up to a contract,
completely.
Being well aware of what that says. And if you're a main contractor who wants the ability to do these things, what would your advice to them be?
So my advice is, if you want to be able to either omit works or terminate without reason, is to say, yes, we want that right, but we will compensate you. And we have discretion as to whether or not we order that, award that scope to others if that's appropriate. So I think they want freedom to do it, but I think having a fixed pre-agreed compensation so you know how much it's going to cost you to do it. I mean, that's great, isn't it? You can make an informed decision if you know what the two options are, continue with this or omit it and pay the price. I think that makes it much easier to make decisions.
Yeah, and it leads to quick, simple commercial decisions. You say to Paul Hemming, we're going to remove those doors, we're going with someone else, happy days, go for it.
Yeah, and if your profit margin's better than 10% or you're hoping to make more than 10%, negotiate that figure up front rather than trying to negotiate when you're on the back foot, when you're already feeling aggrieved because they've taken a load of work off you that you wanted or didn't want to do, whichever. But, you know, it's much easier to have these conversations at the beginning of a project than it is to have them when things have gone slightly wrong or things are not going quite according to plan.
100%, yeah. No, I completely agree. And it has been fantastic talking to you, Sarah. There are so many, you know, I often snip up different parts of episodes and post them with the most interesting bits, the bits with the biggest takeaways. I'm thinking I'm going to be snipping this episode for multiple times for the next few weeks. But thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your expertise and knowledge on two different topics there. It's been so good to have you on this show. I'm going to share your details in the podcast description. Reach out to Sarah. Definitely go and check out what she's doing, because aside from all the great knowledge on current contracts, what you're actually trying to do with the future of construction contracts with 500 words, I personally think is amazing and inspirational. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. And if you don't understand your contracts when you're given them, either get some training or get someone who does understand them to tell you what you shouldn't be signing up to.
100%. Lovely. I will speak to you soon, Sarah, and have a great weekend. Great week, everyone. Speak to you soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.